Thank you, Sue. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is the second of three oral arguments, all via Zoom. The second case is file A22-1509, State of Minnesota versus Cordell Martz Hall, who is the appellant. And we have two attorneys present, so I assume you're ready to proceed. You should be able to see the clock in a corner of your screen. We do ask that you pay attention to that. We are recording this proceeding, so no other recording is allowed. We're also live streaming it, and the audio version will be on the court's website within 24 hours. We do ask counsel when you begin that you do identify yourself for the record and whom you represent. And so counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz, and I'm an assistant appellate public defender. I represent Cordell Hall, and we are here asking this court for a new trial. A punch without an affirmative defense is a fifth degree assault. Now, the punch must also, at a minimum, cause pain, but that's what punches do. They hurt. That's what the state argued at trial, and that's why Hall's prior statements were so damaging. So when defense counsel told the jury that the only thing the state can prove is that Hall punched AMA, he conceded everything the jury needed to find him guilty of fifth-degree assault. And defense counsel's concessions were not limited to one statement. They framed Hall's trial, and they were never offset by a cogent defense theory. Counsel started the trial by telling the jury twice that the state could prove that Hall punched AMA, and ended it by telling the jury that Hall's account of the punch was more credible than AMA's. These are expressed.
The question I have for you, and I agree, I mean, this the admission to the police officer was there, and it was referenced by both prosecutor and defense counsel in an opening. And my question is, how does defense counsel's accurate statement that, yes, my client made this admission to police that he punched AMA, how does that concede the bodily harm element of assault in the fifth degree?
Yeah. So concessions must be viewed in context. And here, I mean, I guess, first of all, you know, right at the end of the opening statement, he says the state can prove that Hall punched AMA. So there's a direct concession of the punch.
I think the state, isn't it more along the lines of the state can prove that he admitted to police that he punched?
That's what he says first. But then on page 163, at the end of his opening statement, he says the state can prove that Hall punched AMA. That's the only thing the state can prove. But to your Honor's point about bodily harm, the concession must be viewed in context. And here, there is nothing about this trial that suggests that the punch was so ineffectual that it wouldn't hurt. And in fact, we have the victim testifying, and we've got pictures that the punch caused him to bleed.
And so there was other evidence, right? Other than the admission to the punch, there was other evidence the state presented. I guess I'm just saying, trying to figure out how this case is like Luby, where in fact, because of the jury instruction given, the concession of premeditation really was a concession to intent, because that's how the jury or the district court instructed that jury. We don't have that here. That seems like a significant difference to me.
Well, if we had some kind of, I mean, in Luby, there was a cogent defense strategy, right? And in, you know, according to Justice Chudich's defense, dissent in that case, we had a 28-page closing argument where the defense attorney very specifically said, we're challenging intent. This is an involuntary intoxication defense, and intent is the contested element. But he made one statement within that closing argument where he said premeditation isn't really disputed here. And the Supreme Court said that was a concession. And here, had the theory at trial been, yes, he punched him, but it didn't cause bodily harm. It didn't cause pain. It was such a weak punch that AMA wasn't hurt, or, you know, it was a friendly punch and it didn't hurt. That would be a weak defense on this record, but at least it would be a defense theory. And we don't have that here. What we have is an admission to the punch. We have no credible challenge, no challenge at all to bodily harm or venue. And there's nothing left. The state didn't have to prove anything else under Dorn and under Fleck. And without, so this was not a tactical confession like you see in say, Hoseman or even some of the other cases where defense counsel concedes heat of passion manslaughter or a lesser degree of the most serious offense in hopes of obtaining an acquittal. There
Ms.
was
Schultz,
just, yeah.
Ms. I'm trying to kind of a same line of questioning on its face. Of course, it does seem like a very good tactical trial maneuver, given that they're going to hear it, and the more serious offense is the one that you're really more concerned about, given his admission. But my question is this: under Huseman, we know that a single element in itself, as the Supreme Court stated, unless the circumstances made it so obvious, would not be sufficient to consider it a concession. I'm wondering where the issue of strategy, which I know also can come into a play in an acquiescence if we say there's a concession, but I'm kind of at that first step. Wouldn't it be under Huseman that under these circumstances, where he's admitted to the law enforcement, and that's generally how the trial attorney said it. There, I didn't catch that unique part of page 163 you're referring to, but the point they seem to combine. He's going to, he they can show that he admitted it, but we want you to find him not guilty of it, nevertheless. How does that play into that point in Huseman that you look at the circumstances? What about these circumstances would make it a concession, notwithstanding their desire to find him not guilty of the assault?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So, I mean, in Huseman, it very clearly was a tactical concession. The defense theory at trial was it doesn't matter how old they were, it doesn't matter how old I am, it doesn't matter where it happened, I didn't do it. The defense was on the element of penetration, and it was consistent throughout trial. That was the defense strategy. It was a tactical concession to gain credibility on the contested element. And that's what the Supreme Court said, is we don't want to disincentivize defense attorneys from focusing on the contested element. But here there was no contested element. The concession to the punch was not tactical in order to focus on, you know, sure, the punch happened, but it wasn't in Stearns County. Or sure, the punch happened, but there wasn't bodily harm. There was no strategy behind this concession.
But wasn't it just a statement of an undisputed fact, as the ages of the victim and the defendant in Hoosman were? I mean, they're just facts that are facts, and the strategy is don't run from the facts, argue other things. I mean, why isn't this like more like Hoosman?
So, I mean, the court in Huseman observes that, you know, the evidence on age was not particularly strong, but that wasn't the defense theory. The defense theory was that he didn't do it, and so the age of the victims was, according to the defense theory, irrelevant. And so it made a lot of sense to concede it and to focus on the actual defense, which is that he didn't do it. Here, the defense was that he did it. There was nothing else. He punched the guy. There was no challenge to bodily harm, no challenge to venue. This is a confession, or this is a concession to all elements. If there was something in the record to show that maybe this punch didn't cause bodily harm, maybe it didn't happen in Stearns County, that would be a circumstance that this court would look at to consider whether it was an actual concession. But when there's nothing like that in the record, there's no other way to read these statements except as concessions to fifth degree assault. And that was the cogent defense theory. He didn't commit robbery, he committed fifth degree assault. And that, you know, as to Judge Slater's question about acquiescence, that's relevant in the acquiescence analysis. We look at whether it was a valid defense strategy, and we have not challenged that. This would have been a valid defense strategy. We haven't challenged that. But the problem is, you can only pursue it if you have the defendant's consent. And the record is absolutely clear that they did not. He
Isn't it
Paul.
true, Ms. Schultz, though, if we were to find that it was a concession, the Luby case confirmed, and really all the cases do, that acquiescence can occur if he understands it, he's heard it, it's been repeated throughout trial, which here it was in the opening statement, was in the closing statement, and he never objected. Would that not be acquiescence under the law?
No, Your Honor, because what those cases say is that if that acquiescence can be implied from the record if It's a strategy that's used throughout trial. It's a valid defense strategy, and there's no objection from the defendant. And here, while we didn't have an on-the-record objection at trial, we have uncontested testimony that Hall said, do not do this. He refused to consent, and he never changed his mind. And that's how he testified, and his defense attorneys both confirmed that. And acquiescence, I mean, the doctrine of acquiescence is not about overriding the defendant's will in pursuit of his best interests. That's not what acquiescence is about. The acquiescence cases are about maybe we don't have an on-the-record concession, but it's clear that, you know, that we don't have any record the defendant's objected, and it seemed like he was on board with this strategy. But that's not what happened here. We know that he objected, and he said, do not do this. I will not consent. And there are, you know, some remaining contested facts for sure. Hall said that he passed his attorneys a note objecting to opening. And that is something that the district court did not make a factual finding about. But we don't really need it because we know that he said no. It's simply not the law and cannot be the law that as long as the defendant doesn't speak up in court and that his defense attorneys are okay to just do whatever they want despite his clear wishes. That's not what these cases say.
Yeah, Ms. Schultz, just the record here. Remind me, is there any evidence that your client told his two trial counsel that they could not comment on the admission your client made to the police officer?
Yeah, so Hall does testify that he told them not to mention it. I think that there is some conflict with his attorney's testimony there that one of his attorneys said that they had talked about the statement. But I don't think that really matters because that is actually not a decision that Hall gets to make. His defense attorneys could certainly, as a matter of trial strategy, comment on his statement. That's not within this really limited universe of choices that only the defendant gets to make. So, you know, that was his testimony, but it doesn't really matter here. What matters is he said, I'm not going to consent to this, or that I don't want to concede, and he never changed his mind.
Given the fact the district court did not reach the issue of acquiescence, I mean, if we agree with you that trial counsel's statements really did amount to a concession of an element and really the element of this offense, would a remand be required to the district court to make a factual finding as to acquiescence?
No, and that's certainly an approach that I guess theoretically this court could take, but there's just no need here because this isn't a case where we don't know what the defendant said and that we need further fact finding as to the conversations between him and his attorneys. This isn't, you know, this court's decision in Boykin or in Pertine or Dukes where we just don't know. We just don't know what it looked like. Here we know. Everyone agrees that Hall said no and that he never changed his mind. And so whether he made any further objections off the record, I think it's just irrelevant here. This is not what acquiescence is. It's not a roadmap for overriding your client's wishes in pursuit of his best interests. This is a decision that only he gets to make. And he just gets to make it. He doesn't have an affirmative obligation to speak up or object if his counsel disregards his wishes. There's no real forum for that. It's not practical to expect that of defendants because he should be able to work this out with his attorneys without interjecting in trial. So I think remand is just unnecessary here because we know what those conversations look like and the evidence is undisputed. So I see my time is running out, but so I will, unless there are other questions from this court, we ask this court to reverse Hall's conviction for fifth degree assault and remand for a new trial.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Schultz. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Counsel, my name is Ole Tweeden. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. Five things remain clear. First, appellant is the one who himself proactively conceded the only thing that his defense attorneys conceded. He conceded that to the lieutenant early on. He conceded that tactically and strategically. His attorneys adopted the fact that that was coming into trial, but that was a piece of evidence they had to deal with, an important piece of evidence. Although we talk only about small parts of that admission discussed a variety of different things and included Mr. Hall's own defense to what had happened, which is he was more credible than what the victim said as to the robbery piece, as the circumstances surrounding the punch. Number two, we have no evidence of any concession by either Mr. Hall himself or either of his attorneys that he inflicted bodily harm on the victim. Therefore, they have not conceded, either he or they later adopting his admission, have not conceded an element. Having not conceded it, the key element in assault in the fifth degree, they cannot possibly have conceded his guilt, which they didn't. That's number three. They specifically asked for not guilty verdicts. Was it a hard road for them to climb? Yes. That's because appellant admitted punching the victim, and there were other evidence the state brought in that showed bodily harm.
Did defense counsel argue to the jury that the act of punching did not cause bodily harm, or challenge the testimony of the victim or the person who picked him up in the car about what he observed about the victim's face? Did the defense counsel challenge that?
They did not, Your Honor. They minimized references to the statement to reference only what an appellant had admitted about the punch and then put it back. Appellant's counsel has talked about opening statement, page 163. So in 162 to 163, you see a preview of all you're going to hear my client admit is this admission. But within this admission, it's just to a punch. And then here's all the things that you, the state hasn't told you about and that you're going to find out about the victim's statement. And they're going to put it together as a, their strategy is to defend the entire case. And so their strategy is, I'm going to defend the entire case with the evidence I've been given, including from my client. And I'm going to say he punched it, but I'm not going to focus on the punch, which he's admitted, and try and say either A, my client's a liar, or B, the punch didn't cause any harm. They just simply decided strategically and appropriately, I don't really want to talk about this photo of the injury to the victim. I'm going to focus on there's another person there, because this is a 2v1 situation, what the state's trying to present. There's no evidence that my client has any money on it. And that starts in the opening statement and it's continued at the end. And so their focus is not, they're addressing it. They're not minimizing it. I think as appellant appropriately concedes, they aren't objectively unreasonable in doing this. So unless he fully, he being both trial counsel A and trial counsel B, fully conceded the element, it doesn't matter if their strategy was after that, okay, I'm only going to talk a little bit about this assault five because I'm probably going to lose, which they did. But I'm going to only talk about a little bit about it. We're delving back into Strickland and general objectively reasonable or unreasonable assistance of counsel. Counsel concedes that they were objectively reasonable, that if their client had expressly consented, yep, we're going to concede entire guilt on count two, they would have been fine. The flip side is, let's say they hadn't. Let's say they had played this out differently. They had attacked, as counsel rightly says, a couple ways you can attack a statement. Hey, he was coerced by law enforcement, even though he proactively reached out to law enforcement and gave this long statement. Let's say they attacked their client's own statement. Arguably, we'd be here on ineffective assistance of counsel on the general Strickland standard, because they'd be attacking a statement that he voluntarily gave and that was helpful in his case. In fact, we may be here on ineffective assistance counsel on conviction on two counts, because his statement differentiating and their entire defense is his statement can be believed. Once it's coming in, it can be believed. It's not a concession of complete guilt, which is why they both asked for not guilty verdicts, but it can be believed. And it was so believable that it overcome anything the state could present from inconsistent statements from the victim. They were successful in that. And counsel appropriately concedes that. They did a good job here. What I have argued in the brief and what the state argues is once he does that, once he admits that, and he admits he did that, if they limit their statement, they being the defense, if they limit their argument to his own admissions, and that could be pretrial, it could happen in the middle of trial. He could blurt out, yep, I punched the guy. He's never conceded guilt on, you know, assault five. Let's say the same scenario, he writes that he testifies at trial. Yep, on cross-examination, fine, I punched him, period. but I'm not guilty, period. Now defense counsel has to what? Get his concession and agreement on the record, get an explicit waiver that now they concede that he punched him? No, they have to be able to argue the evidence that they've been handed in the case. And some of that evidence, as counsel concedes, is a tactical or strategic decision they get to make. Drawing a bright line rule here would allow defense attorneys more understanding of what they can and cannot do. I don't know how, and I don't think the appellant's counsel can say how, and I know appellant himself can't say how, they could have effectively defended this case without talking about his own statement. There's no way to get around it. They have to talk about it. And notably,
Mr. Tweeten, can I ask you, along those lines then, do you believe that sort of, and we're still at step one where the judge left it at, that it was not a concession, is that part of what you think Huseman allows an appellate court to review under the circumstances, including trial strategy, where here it's almost uniformly all agreed it was a good strategy overall, and yet, but it's to one element, although we all also agree it's kind of the element of the offense.
I think that's totally correct. And I would, speaking of concessions, I would concede, obviously, if he conceded himself the completed act, there was no defense, there was no affirmative defense. It doesn't matter that he didn't concede, you know, that happened in Stearns County. Just like it doesn't matter in this case that they didn't argue, well, we don't know that it was in Stearns County when he punched it. That was undisputed as well. So I would agree this is a central element on that count. I would also agree, at least or adopt the suggestion that Your Honor's given, that Huseman does allow for this. In appellant's reply brief, they rejected the idea of this court acting on appellant's admissions and whether or not a defendant's admissions can be used without a concession of guilt as long as they're confined to those admissions. The argument is the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on that. I would argue under Huseman and under the case law, it leaves open this. There aren't cases, and appellant would have cited them if there were, where appellant has directly admitted what they did and counsel has said, you admitted what you did, but you're not guilty. There aren't cases that say, well, you've conceded guilt without respecting the autonomy of the defendant. This is his own autonomy. He has said that this happened. And therefore, in Huseman, not only is it effective trial strategy, they have to be able to do it. They aren't conceding anything more than what he has already conceded himself. Could they obviously argue something else? You know, they could argue it was disputed that he conceded. An untaped confession. You've got a third party witness that says it. If he says it though, and he said, and there's no dispute that Mr. Hall made that statement that he punched the victim, along with all the other statements explaining why. When there's no dispute about that, how can they possibly be conceding guilt outside of his autonomy? He's the one who tactically decided to concede it. In fact, his strategy with the officer, with the lieutenant, was exactly the same as his strategy and their strategy at trial, which is, he's more credible. Yep, this happened, but it was just a punch. And we know, getting back to whether it's a completed element, we know that because one, he had to give a fact basis and he only started with the punch. And when he asked to admit additional elements or additional piece of that element, he couldn't do it. It took him a while to finally get to it because the judge knew and everybody knew, just like the jury knew, you have to prove up the back end of that element, which it caused something. Appellant's brief had initially talked about attempt. I've addressed that in respondent's brief. That wasn't presented to the jury. There wasn't an argument. There wasn't a jig. So I don't think we're in a situation where a punch could theoretically be an attempt to cause bodily harm. That wasn't here before the court. So limited to must have bodily harm or some pain. Appellant's counsel is totally right. Yes, punches hurt. Absolutely. Which is why it's an effective trial strategy to concede an entire guilt of this in this case. But he didn't want to do that. Mr. Hall didn't want to do that. So they didn't. They conceded just part of it. And the more they talk about it, the more ridiculous they could potentially sound. So they limit it to, here's what he conceded. Here's what he said. You're going to hear that. And oh, by the way, guess what? My client's not guilty because he told X, Y, and Z. And the victim did not. The victim had inconsistent statements. The victim couldn't pick out who it was. He had a variety of different things. So in this case, unlike all the other cases where you see much more specific or detailed or against the client's wishes, concessions of guilt. All the way from the federal case law where you have my strategy is to keep you off a capital case. And so I'm just going to override your will to, well, I'm going to concede pre-med, not apparently understanding that that also concedes intent. Or you have one of the cases cited, I apologize if I butcher it, Buscarum in appellant's reply brief. Well, that's a stipulated facts trial where the appellant is nowhere around. And in that case, Mr. Buscarum doesn't know that his attorney is directly writing, I concede guilt of count two, I concede guilt of count three, et cetera. Those are the cases where they're truly overriding his autonomy. And we know in the alternative reason, one thing I agree with appellant's counsel on this is, although appropriate action could be remand, I don't think we need it, but for the opposite reasons. On acquiescence, you have nothing in the record about this note until 9 months later. You have nothing in the record about an outburst, which he claims, if you believe Mr. Hall, he claims in his post-conviction testimony, he argued that he was going to create a mistrial. He is not his first time riding the horse, which it's not. He knew what he had to do if he wanted to. He played the wait and see approach with this trial. If he made this statement, it's unbelievable. And it arguably would be a clear error if the district court had found that Mr. Hall passed a note right after opening statement and then later testified, somewhat inconsistent with his affidavit, that, oh, by the way, I had a conversation with my two attorneys directly. Do not be talking about my statement. Not just don't concede guilt of both, which they didn't, but don't be talking about my statement.
Mr. Tweet, wouldn't we need, though, if we got to that point, because the judge stopped at the first step, made no findings, wouldn't we have to remand at least for findings since we don't make those findings ourselves?
I believe there's enough findings in the record of the factual findings that you see that you could make that there is no possibility that this could have happened the way he said it. Because you have the transcript, you have her findings of what happened in terms of the back and forth during the trial, and you have what happened afterwards. You don't have an objection. The objection doesn't come till 9 months later. You don't have any indication between trial and sentencing that there was an issue. And you did have that in this case. You had that in the first, when he first pled, he claimed he actually lied to the district court in open court when he said his plea, when he said he wasn't doing it just to get out of jail. He says, nope, actually, I was lying about that. I just did it to get out of jail. There are multiple instances where he's directly contradicted himself and admitted lying in this case. And those credibility pieces don't go away. So we could send it back, have the district court make their own findings, and then come back here and find out if there's clear error in those findings. I would argue that it would be clear error for the court to find that with nothing in the record about him objecting, and nothing from both of his attorneys indicating that he has objected, that his both memory and credibility overweighs both of his attorneys and the absence of the record. What you do have in the record, as noted both in the record and the findings, is you have multiple times where the trial stopped, where there's objections raised, where there's communication. You have a previous pretrial incident where there's a note, and the note is passed to, I called him trial counsel A, the first trial counsel who did the closing statement. And trial counsel A brings up to the court, hey, my client's passed me a note, we need time to talk. You have that happening. You don't have that happening anywhere else in the trial transcript. So I would argue that it would be clear error to find, if the court went back to the court, they made findings, and they found, not with any new testimony, there's nothing to be done, that yes, he did it. He did pass a note, and he passed the note, and he demanded that this stop. And then he let the entire trial go, didn't acquiesce throughout the rest of the trial, got to closing argument, and waited to see what happened. And now that he got what he wanted, which is same thing he tactically conceded to the officer, what they conceded, which is he made this statement, and they asked for not guilties, and he got the big one. And now he wants the second one because he's changed his mind 9 months later about what he says he happened. And so because of all that, I think you can rule on it. I understand, obviously, remand would allow another judge to rule. But I think it's pretty clear on this record that the credibility determination cannot be that he passed this note and he didn't acquiesce. Because even if he passed the note, he spent the rest of the trial interacting with the court, interacting with his attorneys, and his attorney adopted exactly what they said in the opening, in closing, and it was successful. It just didn't get him off both counts, and there was no way for him to do that, likely, given his admission. So for that reason, I ask that you not remand, and that you find that, like other cases have found in the past, that there was acquiescence here. And I see my time is closing, so I'd ask that you uphold the district court's ruling on either of those bases. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, Ms. Schultz, you now may have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I apologize, Your Honor. Thank you. I've got a few points to make here. The first is, I really don't say this lightly, but it is absurd to say that it would be clear error for the district court to find that he passed this note. He says he passed the note. His counsel said, I don't remember, it was a year ago. And one of his trial counsel said, yeah, defendants pass notes that are irrelevant all the time. The district court could easily find that his actually undisputed testimony that he objected during the trial was credible. But we don't have to do that because respondent is suggesting a very profound change in the law, which is that it's not just that you need your client's consent to concede guilt, but you can find out that he doesn't concede. You can move forward with the concession. And as long as he doesn't say on the record, interrupt trial to say that he doesn't consent, that he objects, that's okay. That is not the law, and it cannot be the law. If defendants have an affirmative duty to object to what their counsel is doing on the record, we need to tell them. We need to tell them before trial, hey, if you have concerns about what your attorney is doing, you need to tell the judge, because otherwise you're going to waive your chance to ever challenge this later. That's not the law. And if that were the law, then we wouldn't have the Supreme Court would not have remanded in Pertine and Dukes to figure out if there was a concession off the record or acquiescence off the record. And this court wouldn't have remanded in Boykin, where there was not on the record objection. It's just not the law. And I would also really push back on this idea that Hall employed a wait and see approach. It is absolutely uncontested that he refused to do this. He didn't change his mind later once he from the very beginning, against the advice of counsel, he said, I will not consent. I will not concede fifth degree assault. He's not coming. This is not a case where he was silent, where he kind of acquiesced or was a little bit squirrely about what he really wanted to do. He said very clearly, I do not want to do this. He does not
Ms. Schultz,
have.
Can I ask you, you said repeatedly it's not the law, but the quote from Luby is this court may infer the defendant acquiesced if the concession was an understandable strategy and the defendant was present and understood a concession was made, but failed to object. Isn't that what we have here? Because as you point out, it was no hidden fact that the opening statement, his attorney said that you will hear that he admitted to the punch. And so that was so obviously the strategy. And your client seems not to disagree over that it was an objectively reasonable strategy. So wouldn't Luby suggest that that's what happened here?
No, Your Honor. Luby doesn't say it has to be an on-the-record objection. It's the appellant's burden to show error on appeal. And in that case, the appellant did not show that there was an objection. But Hall did here. We stayed this appeal. We remanded to district court and we made a record to show that Hall did object. And again, if an on-the-record objection was required, then we wouldn't have gotten remands in Pertine and Dukes with this court's decision in Boykin. And Huseman as well, there's a footnote saying, basically, if we had found that this was a concession, the record is undeveloped as to whether he consented or acquiesced. And that was, you know, in Huseman, that was a written closing. So it is a slightly different situation. But reviewing courts do remand to make sure that we know what happened. And in fact, in Dukes and then in a footnote in Boykin, this court said these kinds of issues should be raised in a petition for post-conviction relief because they require fact-finding into the conversations between the defendant and his counsel. And that's what we did here. And we established an undisputed fact that he did not consent to this. Again, if he had some kind of affirmative duty to speak up on the record, I don't know how he was supposed to know about it We can't hold defendants to that kind of standard. It's unworkable. It's impractical. And it's defense counsel's burden to get their consent. Defense counsel didn't do that here. And under Minnesota law, he's entitled to reversal. So we ask this court for a new trial.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions this morning, as well as your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day.
Thank you, Rana.
Thank you.